Nearly 50,000 asylum seekers have been sent back across the border since the start of an immigration policy known as Remain in Mexico.
I don't have anywhere to go. I don't have anything. I don't know anything about Mexico. I don't know anything. They tell me that here, where we are staying, they kidnap people. And I don't know what to do.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, for October 3rd, a look at the human toll of the Trump administration's asylum overhaul. Also on the show, why is everyone so serious about the Joker?
I think the problem with this movie, to me, is that all the outrage and the cynicism feels very borrowed. It feels a bit like a pose to me.
We'll talk about the new movie and why it doesn't have everyone laughing. All that on The Takeaway. Let's get going. Earlier this year, a man named David presented himself and his child to U.S. immigration officials requesting asylum. But under an asylum policy change called the Migrant Protection Protocols, David was sent to Mexico to wait for his day in court. We've disguised his voice for his protection. I don't have anywhere to go. I don't have anything, David is saying there, just moments after being returned over the border to Mexico. Due to the danger David and his family still face, we are omitting some identifying details, including his home country. And for the rest of the segment, we will only be using an English language translation of his words. David is not his real name.
They tell me that here, where we're staying, they kidnap people. And I don't know what to do.
Just 5 hours after the U.S. government sent David and his child to the border town of Nuevo Laredo, Tamaulipas, he was kidnapped by cartel members.
I saw when they killed a man. They killed him because he tried to run away. I saw how they beat people.
The state of Tamaulipas, where David was sent and then kidnapped, is a hotbed for organized crime. It's listed on the U.S. State Department's Do Not Travel list because of the high rates of violence. The Department of Homeland Security started sending asylum seekers there under the Migrant Protection Protocols in July of this year.
I could not stop crying. One of the men told me that my child's kidneys were good to remove. Nobody could leave.
David's sister, who lives in the United States, spent days desperately trying to negotiate his release. And after she paid a ransom to the cartel, they dropped David off at a bus station in Nuevo Laredo.
Mexican immigration agents turn migrants over. They know exactly what they're doing. They do not have a heart. They don't have dignity. They only do what they have to do in order to turn you over. They don't care if you are killed.
But David's Remain in Mexico story is not unique. Under the Trump administration, the U.S. government has sent nearly 50,000 asylum seekers to Mexico while they wait for their day in court. And today we're going to examine the Migrant Protection Protocol's policy and its effect on asylum seekers nearly 9 months after it began. Emily Green is with us. She's a freelance reporter based in Mexico who wrote David's story for Vice News. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us in studio is Jonathan Blitzer, staff writer for The New Yorker. Jonathan, great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Emily, you reported David's story for Vice. You shared the audio with us. We really appreciate that. Is David safe?
No, I don't think so. He is still in Mexico. He is no longer in Nuevo Laredo, but I would not say that he is safe. After his kidnapping, he was essentially living in a small room in the house of a friend of his sister's, and he was too terrified to leave. He just stayed in the room for days on end. I think things have gotten better and that he has come up with the courage to leave, and he is operating and functional, but I would hardly call him safe.
Jonathan, you were in Ciudad Juarez reporting on the Remain in Mexico policy. Is David's case typical? I mean, what are you hearing from asylum seekers that you talk to?
I think people are absolutely horrified and terrified, not just because of cartel activity, but all of the other associated dangers with some of these northern Mexican border cities. And I think one of the important things that's come through in Emily's reporting is specifically the idea that this policy puts migrants at risk because it exposes them particularly to criminal groups who can extort them. And one of the most common things I would hear is that people, the most vulnerable moment in the lives of these migrants as they've been returned to Mexico is specifically the moment after which they've been returned. There's kind of a narrow window, as I heard it in interviews, during which most of the criminal activity tended to occur, precisely because that is the moment when the combination of American and Mexican immigration agents are essentially putting a target on the back of these migrants.
Emily, you are reporting from Nuevo Laredo. The state, as we mentioned, has been flagged by the U.S. State Department for its violence. Give us a sense of the situation there. Are officials attempting to help migrants?
Nuevo Laredo is a place of complete and utter impunity. I've spent a lot of time on the border, and I've never been in a place like that where criminal activity just runs so rampant and there are no repercussions. And just like Jonathan said, one of the most dangerous times for migrants is right after they are returned. They are returned to Mexican immigration officials, and essentially no help is provided them. When I was there, migrants were given two options. One, the Mexican government would put them on a bus to a location some 30 hours away on the Mexican-Guatemalan border, or they had to basically go it alone in Nuevo Laredo. I just want to paint a picture for you. Right outside of the offices of Mexican immigration, there was a two-door truck, a white truck, just sitting there. And it's what the locals refer to as los malos, the bad guys. Essentially, the cartels are just sitting outside the offices of Mexican immigration to see who comes and who goes. It is completely wild. And when the migrants are sent back, there's no support given them. It's not like we're going to take you to a shelter or we're going to take you to the bus station. So it's incredibly dangerous those first few hours after they are returned. And indeed, David was kidnapped 5 hours after he was returned by U.S. immigration officials to Mexico.
Jonathan, one question that stands out to me is, like, how are these cities chosen to be part of this program, if you will? Are they chosen? Is it just the default because they happen to be on the border? Do the cities benefit at all from doing this, or does this just increase the level of crime and insecurity in these cities?
It's a good question. I think, in effect, the reason these cities have been sort of conscripted into this Remain in Mexico or MPP policy is because they're border cities, and they tend to be these major transit points for Central American migrants primarily. The U.S. government has essentially rolled this program out over the last 9 months. So it started on the Pacific coast in Tijuana, and month by month, slowly sort of moved into increasingly dangerous areas farther east. And so the area where Emily has been doing her reporting is notorious for being one of the most dangerous places, probably in Central America, a place with a long history of cartel activity, and even more specifically, cartel activity premised on the extortion of migrants. And so these are places that we already know a lot about. We know that they're not safe. We know that they're under-equipped to deal with this sudden influx of migrants. But their main utility for the U.S. government rolling out this program is simply their proximity to these ports of entry along the border.
Jonathan, what's supposed to happen? Folks are not supposed to be kidnapped by drug cartels. So what was the plan when the United States or the Trump administration rolled this out? So I'm a migrant. I cross the U.S. southern border pleading asylum. I'm sent back to Mexico, regardless of whether I'm from there or not. What's supposed to happen in this scenario?
In my understanding, there are sort of two broad ways of thinking about this. The first is essentially that the administration has become obsessed with the fact of people seeking asylum at the U.S. border basically being allowed to live in the U.S. while their claims are pending in the American immigration courts. So to the Trump administration, this has been described as catch and release. It's been described as open borders. Pick your term. But essentially, the administration has tried to prevent migrants from even having access to U.S. soil during the course of their asylum claims going through the court process. And so the idea, the sort of first broad way of understanding this policy is to think, okay, what the administration is trying to do here is it's trying to essentially give Central American and other asylum seekers, but primarily Central American asylum seekers, access to U.S. immigration courts without giving them access to the U.S. And so the idea is to essentially shuttle them back and forth between these northern Mexican border cities and immigration courts in the U.S. every month, every several weeks when their court dates come up. And so the idea is essentially to string out someone's very long-term asylum adjudication while that person is basically living in Mexico and crossing the border every time it's the indicated moment to go before court. So that's the first broad way of understanding it. The second broad way I've come to understand this policy is essentially as a kind of punitive mechanism that's meant to deter asylum seekers from even attempting the trip. So if word gets out, of course, that when you come to the U.S. and seek asylum, you're going to be shunted to Mexico. Imagine being shunted to Tamaulipas or Ciudad Juarez. You are essentially going to think twice about what you're doing and whether or not you even want to pursue your asylum claim. And so a key part of what this policy has meant in effect is that huge numbers of people, thousands of people, have abandoned their asylum claims because it's so unsafe to remain in Mexico. And so that is also one of the byproducts, I would argue, intended of the policy. U.S. officials would deny that specifically. But the idea is to both cause people to abandon their claims and the flip side of that is for people not to be able to make their court dates. Some people have missed court dates because they've been kidnapped. Others haven't been able to make court dates because they've lost their identification, because they've been stolen. They've not been able to make it back to the port of entry in time. And so what that results in is their immediate, what's called a final order of removal. In other words, short-circuiting their asylum process and thus basically ending their entire asylum claim.
Emily, what is, if there is any infrastructure in place in these border towns where folks who are being sent back to Mexico can actually seek refuge, whether that be churches, shelters? Are there human rights organizations or attorneys helping folks on the ground there?
There are shelters in places like Ciudad Juarez. I believe the shelters are overrun. There's just simply too many people and not enough space. And that's something that Jonathan has reported on. In places like Nuevo Laredo, one of the major issues is that the asylum seekers have zero access to U.S. attorneys. And there's been a lot of data about if you have an attorney, you have a much higher chance of winning your asylum claim. But U.S. lawyers are simply too scared to go into Nuevo Laredo and counsel clients. So you are also effectively limiting asylum seekers from being able to win their case because they don't have access to attorneys. In Nuevo Laredo and also in Matamoros and other places along the border, what you see are just thousands of migrants waiting for months on end. They often don't have work. They're often too scared to go out and work. And so they're just stuck. And it's really a disheartening situation. And I want to emphasize that it's something that I think people have no idea that it's going on. You know, back in the spring, we saw these images of thousands of asylum seekers in El Paso, Texas, and McAllen, Texas. But right now, it's all on the Mexican side of the border, and it's completely out of sight and out of mind.
Jonathan, why did the Mexican government agree to this policy? Remind us the history here.
Yeah, I mean, that remains a real question. Essentially, how I've come to understand the genesis of this MPP policy is as a kind of alternative that emerged when negotiations that were going on between the U.S. and Mexico failed on another front. So basically last year, one of the things the Trump administration was trying to do with Mexico was get the country to agree to what's called a safe third country agreement. That agreement basically would mean that asylum seekers would have to seek asylum in Mexico rather than the U.S. And so if someone were to show up seeking asylum at the U.S. border, the U.S. could turn that person away, send them to Mexico and say, look, you have a shot to apply for asylum. It's just not in the U.S. It's got to be in Mexico. Now, the Mexican government has dragged its feet on that and has resisted from the start. That hasn't kept the administration from pushing, and it pushes to this day. But in the meantime, basically, I would say in the fall of last year, an alternative emerged, and it was an idea that had been kicking around for some time, and it ended up being this policy, Remain in Mexico, MPP. And in effect, the Mexican government is between a rock and a hard place in many ways in terms of how it's dealing with the Trump administration. The Trump administration has already threatened things like tariffs, threatened all kinds of punitive measures. I tend to think those measures are largely a bluff, and I actually feel like Mexico, of all of the countries in Central America, has the most bargaining power and the most leverage in its back and forth with the U.S. on these points. Nevertheless, the new president of Mexico, Manuel López Obrador, is very conscious of not wanting to anger the Trump administration too much. He's got an ambitious domestic agenda of his own. I think for the most part, this Remain in Mexico or MPP policy was kind of seen by the Mexican government as a kind of middle of the road alternative to the other things that were on the table, which shows you how far to the right the whole conversation has shifted, that a policy like this is seen under the circumstances as being relatively sort of modest.
Emily, are the folks that you're talking to, local mayors, local police forces, able to handle what's happening? Because there obviously there's been an increase in crime and instability in some of these areas that were already trying to handle this.
Right. 50,000 people, asylum seekers, have been sent back under this policy to Mexico. And it strikes me as a game of hot potato. You know, they're sent to Nuevo Laredo. The mayor there doesn't want them. So he ships them off to Monterrey. The mayor in Monterrey doesn't want them. So they ship them off to Chiapas. And one of the things I want to emphasize that's so striking to me in my reporting is that they are being kidnapped writ large at bus stations in these border cities. And so Mexico has accepted this policy and yet accepted zero obligation to protect the migrants. It says it does, but it really doesn't.
This fight is not over here in the United States either. The U.S. Ninth Circuit heard arguments regarding a lawsuit which challenges this policy essentially. Jonathan, where does that go from here?
Well, we'll see. I mean, the arguments were on Tuesday of this week. The judges seemed, on the Ninth Circuit, seemed pretty skeptical of the legality of this policy. We can only hope that there's a swift resolution in the courts. I imagine whatever the resolution is, if it goes against the administration will challenge it. And so we'll kind of continue on this path. I do want to stress one thing, and it's good that you bring up the legal challenge. One thing I've heard is that on the Mexican side, this is to the question of why the Mexican government would agree to such an insane policy. I had always heard from former Mexican officials that there was an expectation on the Mexican side that a policy like this would actually get held up in U.S. federal court. And so from a political standpoint, the incoming Mexican government, because at the time it had just only recently been elected, thought, all right, let's sort of be smart about this. We don't have to be the one to pull the plug on this arrangement. We can let this thing go to the courts. It'll get challenged in the U.S. courts. It'll get enjoined. It'll get blocked. And we'll kind of be off the hook. I do know that was part of the conversation. And I think sort of one of the ways that I've come to understand the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico on these points is, you know, you look on the U.S. side of the border and effectively U.S. domestic politics and this obsession with immigration in that context is dictating U.S. foreign policy. The inverse is almost happening on the Mexican side. The main people within the Mexican government who've pushed this policy aren't members of the Interior Ministry who are mostly opposed to it. It's been members of the Foreign Ministry who are trying to keep relationships good with the Trump administration.
Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and Emily Green is a freelance reporter based in Mexico who shared her audio of David with us. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
At the top of the show, we heard the voice of David, one of thousands of people who've been subjected to the Migrant Protection Protocols policy. But I want to bring you a few more voices now of other migrants affected by the policy. Dani Marrero-He is an outreach coordinator with the Texas Civil Rights Project, and she spoke with several Cubans seeking asylum because of their LGBTQ status. They're now stuck in Matamoros, Mexico because of the MPP policy. Here are Mari, Dylan, and Alberto.
In Mexico, there is a lot of violence. We arrived, and the first thing we found is that the police took all of the money we have.
Here, there's a lot of bullying in the LGBTQ community. They're very aggressive, and they don't tolerate it.
Friends that I've come with have been kidnapped, and they have been extorted for money. And so you live around that. That thing has happened. I mean, it could happen to you any day. I mean, we're living in an apartment building because we're renting. This happens every week. I mean, the police goes and just knocks on your door and asks for papers and just tells you, what are you doing here? And they're just looking for money.
It is not fair what they're doing to us. Everyone's going through a hard time. But us, we are a bit more vulnerable than others. If there is something that says that vulnerable populations should not be in this process here, I don't know why we are here.
We're not here because we just want to be here. We're here because we have we've been left with no other choice but that.
That was Mari, Dylan, and Alberto, Cuban asylum seekers stuck in Matamoros, Mexico, because of MPP or Remain in Mexico. Thanks to the Texas Civil Rights Project for sharing their stories with us.
I'm Amy Walter, and I'm the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, we get behind the chaotic headlines from Washington and tell you how policies in this country are actually changing.
You're going to see access to health care determined by where you live.
Tribalism works.
There is a crisis of institutional decay.
Money follows power.
Join me each week on Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway.
For decades, audiences have made it clear that they like their villains with a good sense of humor. And there's one character that filmmakers keep coming back to who always has a smile on his face.
Come, my comic cohort in crime!
Ha, ha, ooh, hee, ha, ha. And I thought my jokes were bad.
You can call me Joker. And as you can see, a lot happier.
That was Cesar Romero, Heath Ledger, and Jack Nicholson with their takes on The Joker. In 2016, Jared Leto tried his hand at the role, but just 3 years later, DC is hoping that filmgoers are ready for yet another version of the Killer Clown, this time played by Joaquin Phoenix in director Todd Phillips' Joker. The film doesn't come out until tomorrow, but it's already generating a divisive response. While some critics are hailing the film as a dramatic milestone in the superhero film genre, others are wondering whether it lends too much sympathy to its violent main character. Joining me now to weigh in on all this are Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hi, Tanzina.
And Allison Wilmore, film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. Allison, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So happy that we're here again. Allison, I mean, I heard this and I said, really? Do we need another Joker movie? Really? We do? Do you think? Where are we?
Well, I don't think we have any choice at that point,
okay.
You know, especially when it comes to any superhero. I think that we are locked in a constant cycle of like watching maybe them trail away and then start over from the beginning.
Got it.
Yeah. But this one is definitely different. It doesn't really tie into a whole larger universe. It's a kind of standalone movie. It attempts to be, if not psychologically realistic, at least psychologically grittier. And it's got a lot of Martin Scorsese references, more than, say, your standard DC references.
Speaking of, what does the origin story look like, Rafer, for the Joker in this film? I mean, kind of off of Allison's point, it's not as connected to other films in the DC universe.
Right. We're no longer in the vat of chemicals origin story that we had in past films that gave the Joker his, you know, his strange look and his green hair. You know, he's a real world character, Arthur Fleck. He's got a real name. He's a guy living in sort of, you know, near poverty in Gotham City in the early 80s, which is clearly a stand-in for Manhattan at the time. Very gritty, run-down, you know, rotting city. He lives with his mom, played by Frances Conroy. He's a struggling stand-up comedian and a part-time clown, which is too bad because he seems in the film to inspire loathing and cruelty in pretty much everyone he meets.
Oh, God.
So he's picked the wrong career and this kind of resentment, and clearly also a mental illness that he has, and also a medical condition which causes him to laugh uncontrollably at inappropriate moments. All of this makes a very poor choice for a comedian, and he takes this resentment out eventually on society.
So at the top of the show, Allison, we heard Cesar Romero's version of the Joker, Heath Ledger's version, Jack Nicholson's version. We have Joaquin Phoenix stepping into the role now. What's your assessment of his performance?
Well, you know, this character has kind of toggled between being this outrageous character and then being this much darker character, both in the comics and in movies. And I would say that this is probably the darkest version we've gotten, but also I would say the one that, you know, for better and worse, has the most kind of resonances to a particular type of, like, white male rage that I would say we are contending with a lot in the real world these days, in the non-Gotham City world. And I think that the movie, you know, really leans into that in a really committed performance from Joaquin Phoenix that I think is intended to and certainly will make you feel uneasy watching it just because of what it evokes.
Rafer, how much of that has to do with Todd Phillips' direction here? He wrote and directed the film. He's known for things like the Hangover trilogy. So what was his take on all this?
You know, I think as we've heard from him, he apparently got a little sick of woke culture, quote unquote, and decided to move out of comedies into drama.
That seems to be a trend, by the way. Lots of people getting tired. White guys getting tired of woke culture.
That's right. Okay. He decided to move into a drama. I think, as Allison noted, there are a lot of Scorsese references, and I think Phillips had the idea to make the kind of movie that he probably liked from the 70s, these very incisive, sharp, shocking social commentary films. Clockwork Orange is in this movie. Network is in this movie. Taxi Driver, King of Comedy. It's a long list of movies that he's borrowing from here. I think the problem with this movie, to me, is that all the outrage and the cynicism feels very borrowed. It feels a bit like a pose to me, like he wanted to make that kind of movie, but he didn't actually have anything to say underneath it. And I think that's one of the things that people are responding to with this movie when they're calling it irresponsible or dangerous. I think what they're seeing here is just what looks like kind of a one note of violence and self-pity without any kind of underlying real trenchant commentary.
Allison, what was your take on Todd Phillips' comment about woke culture and his critique about leaving comedy because of that?
You know, it's funny because I can't recall a time in which Todd Phillips, who, you know, has made some very successful R-rated, edgy comedies, I don't recall a time in which anyone attempted to cancel him, you know?
Right.
So I don't know, you know, he is speaking at large. I don't know what happened to him in, like, back rooms where he's been pitching projects, but, like, it's a little exasperating for me to hear that, not just because who tends to make that complaint and how little they actually seem to be hurt by people yelling at them on Twitter, but also it's hard for me not to be cynical about it and read a certain amount of strategy into that, because these days that's a kind of dog whistle for a type of audience to be like, you know, the PC police are trying to keep me down, but you should come out and support my project, like my project, which like is bold and like says things people are afraid to say. And I think, you know, I don't think I dislike it as much as Rafer, I think, does. But I also agree. I don't know that it has a lot to actually say.
Off of that point, Rafer, I mean, there's been criticism that the movie is just glorifying the Joker and his violence. What did you think of that critique?
Well, one thing I would say, I do think that Todd Phillips actually did get a lot of flack for the Hangover movies, but sort of post-Hangover in a way. I think people started looking back at it a little bit and criticizing the film for being a glorification of essentially white guys behaving badly and literally getting away with murder, and the women are nowhere to be seen, and everyone thought that was very funny. And so there was this sense that Todd Phillips was making these kinds of movies. And he did War Dogs, which was very similar, a little more realistic and darker, but very similar. And I do think that also plays into the reception that I think this movie has gotten. I feel like people kind of don't trust someone like Todd Phillips to make an incisive point about the Joker. And I think there's a little bit of a suspicion that maybe he identifies too strongly or maybe hasn't thought hard enough about what he's putting up on screen.
Allison, we've got about 10 seconds in the segment. Your thoughts on how well this film is going to do over the weekend? I mean, is it going to attract the typical Joker crowd?
Yeah, I think it'll perform well. I don't think it'll do the numbers that maybe a standard typical superhero movie will, but I think there's a lot of brand recognition there. People will come.
You're not kidding about brand recognition. Allison Wilmore is a film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine, and Rafer Guzman is our film critic here at The Takeaway and at Newsday. Thanks so much to you both.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. If you don't already, make sure to follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. You can find me at Tanzina Vega. And of course, we're on Facebook and Instagram. Our team includes producers Alexandra Boti, Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Jivika Varma, Rob Gunther, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Andres O'Hara. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. Our engineers are Vince Fairchild and Claire McKean. Our director and sound designer is Jake Howitt.
David Gable is our administrative assistant, and Lita Hollowell is our intern. Deirdre Depke is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you'll join us next time. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.